a shot in the dark, wary sort of spark. I'm a light that's too bright for me to see.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right. Oh, man. Episode 232. Crazy schedule this week. Recording this one early. So, wow. Got up at the crack of dawn. You know, I really want to be an early riser. I do. I want to be that grown-up guy that goes to bed at like 9 and gets up at like 4:45, 5 o'clock, goes downstairs, makes a coffee, you know, sits on the front porch and read my breviary, you know, has a cup of coffee and prays before he gets up and goes to work early and beats all the traffic in. I want to be that guy. I really do. But I am just a night owl by nature. But and so 2 nights ago, I tried to pull that off. I was super tired from travel. And it's part of the reason yesterday's show was just kind of ragged and disorganized. I was just exhausted. I tried to go to bed early, and I woke up in the middle of the night and couldn't go back to sleep. And I ended up getting like 5 hours, you know, barely. And because I just couldn't get back to sleep. And so last night, I was just like so tired. And I forced myself to go to bed. I stayed up until a decent hour, even though I was very tired. I stayed up until a little after 10 and then got up at 5:30. So that's a little better. And I managed to stay asleep pretty much the whole time. So maybe I could get past my night owl ways. I'm going to have to at some point, because as I get older, I have a hard time sleeping in sometimes, you know? And so I used to be like, my preferred mode of engagement with the world was like stay up till 2-3 in the morning and sleep till like 10. And I used to just from working night jobs for years, being a college student, not scheduling like an 8 a.m. class, or being working as a wine steward for years. My mic is drooping today, you know? Just going to leave that one alone. So, yes, it was raining when I got up this morning, and I was like, oh, please don't be traffic. Please don't be wrecks this early. It's so early. How could there possibly be wrecks? And there wasn't. I did, however, have a headlight out, which I'm like, oh, really? Man, I literally don't have a moment that I can, because my car is just like, getting to the headlights are just insane. I don't know what it is. They designed this car, like, I don't know what they were thinking. And the headlights, like if you get grease from your finger on them, they'll like pop and stuff. It's like you basically have to, I mean, you can learn how to be a mechanic, but you basically have to be a mechanic to replace these stupid lights. Now you can learn to do it. I mean, I should just bite the bullet and learn to do it, but I'm about to get rid of this car. And at this point in the game, I don't really want to give any effort to that particular skill. So, because I've changed lights on every other headlight I've ever had because they were easy. These are just a whole different ballgame. So I got to try to figure out when in the world I want to get a headlight. I don't want to, yeah. See, there's where I'm at. My schedule is full enough that I am scheduling getting a headlight replaced for like next week sometime. I know you're thinking you're hearing coffee slurps and it's my normal coffee slurp. That's not true. So I'm revisiting an old favorite today. I am, the coffee itself is Ethiopia Alolabor from Commonwealth Coffee, which is absolutely stunning. But normally when you hear me drinking coffee, it's either batch brew, which is like, you know, made with a big commercial brewer for like a coffee house, or it's a pour over. Where I'm, you know, imitating that pour process where water gets poured over coffee. Today I'm drinking French press coffee. And I was staying with Ann Breiling in Santa Cruz over the weekend, and their French press is just how they make their coffee. And so I was getting up in the morning and making French press coffee, and I kind of got a taste for it again. I like the texture of it. And so for all you French pressers out there, I recently started changing how I do my French press. And I've been getting more coffee-ish on this blog, probably because I'm consulting on coffee so much here lately. But, I used to be a Nazi, you know, very, very coarse ground, you know, by weight, a 1 to 15 or 1 to 17, somewhere in their ratio of coffee to water, and by grams. And but I was this Nazi about 4 minutes. I mean, I was one of those guys that, you know, had the timer, and I would let it bloom, and I would pour, and then it's like, you know, and then me and this microphone are going to go round and round. If you hear, like, mic noise, it's me, like, trying to get this arm to say stay in the right position. And then I'd have my little timer in 4 minutes. I mean, 4 minutes. I changed different times when you stir, when you don't stir, different people I would listen to. Back when I used to make a lot of French press, I used to serve. I still serve French press in my shop, but no one ever orders it. So I'm going to slurp during this segment for effect, not because I want a lot more coffee, because I'm tired. But here's the thing, though. This 4 minute thing. Someone started challenging this, and I started thinking about it. So there's this thing we do in the coffee world called cupping, right? And cupping is when you do a fairly coarse ground on some coffee grounds, and you put them in, like, usually this little ceramic bowl that's been preheated, or these little glass 8-ounce Gibraltar Libby cups, the same ones that we serve flat white in. And you do this thing where you pour really hot water over them, you know, and then you wait like a minute, and then you kind of stir each one. And then you're kind of you break the crust, and you smell it, and then it settles. And you kind of scrape some stuff off the top, you know. But there's grounds in the bottom of this cup, and you're tasting it as it cools and stuff, and you're not straining it or anything. So those grounds are sitting in that coffee for sometimes up to 40 minutes. You're letting it go all the way to room temperature, right? But they don't over-extract. That's how everyone tastes to buy coffee and stuff, especially. But a lot of roasters and retailers use that same method. So, what is a French press except for a giant cupping cup? So, I've started getting completely just laid back. I read this article. I think it was by James Hoffman, if I remember right. And I just started being completely disregarding to this whole 4 minute time. So, just now, I put the right amount of coffee in, right amount of water, stirred it, put the lid on, came downstairs, set up all my equipment, got myself ready to do the show. And at the last minute, I kind of pushed, and it's probably 7-8 minutes when it's all said and done. This coffee is delicious, and this mic is falling down. I don't know what the deal is. This coffee is delicious. So I'm telling you what, I am this, you won't hear this very often. Here's me being dramatically less coffee Nazi and giving all you people out there making your coffee first thing in the morning an excuse to be a little less exacting with your standards. So go ahead, grind that coffee up, throw it in your preheated French press, you know, and then pour your hot water on it, give it a quick stir, go get in the shower, you know, come back out, wet hair, robe, push, you know, don't worry about it. As long as you get at least 3-4 minutes on it, give 4 minutes for sure, I'd say. But beyond that, you know, there's some room. There you go. See? You won't hear this very often, me lowering your methodological standards on coffee prep, on manual brewing. You won't hear that very often. All right, I figured out what's going on with this mic. It's not the little thing that I keep tightening. It's this other little thing, which has a nut on it, like a little screw. I'm going to need a screwdriver to fix this. Aha, see? See, look at me. You get to listen to me be problem solving right here on the air. The counter position. I love the counter position, and I love all of you listeners who love the counter position. All right, so last night I got my new iPhone, and I went as far as to open the box. I was so tired. It was like, in my new phone that I have now, my computer has been kind of rejecting it here lately and going, we can't back this up because it's not the same phone or something. So it's confusing it with my old phone. I'm a little worried about this whole transfer of stuff So I'm like, you know what? I just don't have enough bandwidth to do this tonight. So I put my brand new phone back in the box, stuck it in my bag. I just didn't even touch it last night. So today I'm going to be setting up a new iPhone. And I tell you what, I sat next to that Google programmer in first class on the way out to Santa Cruz. Oh, first class, how I love you. I'm really bummed because I've went and I researched the details of the premier kind of like silver level thing that I'm trying to get to on United so I can upgrade more often. And oh man, and without me like radically changing my life and being purposefully taking a bunch of weird flights for no reason or something, just little quick turnarounds, like I don't think I have enough travel between now and the end of the year. Even if I took big segments on everyone, I don't think I can get to the end of it. I started too late, which means I'm going to have to spend all next year earning it, and I'm not going to be able to upgrade all next year. So I'm trying to figure it out. I'm going to call Matt Tyne. Shout out to Matt Tyne. I just saw him in St. Louis at Father Reginald Wolfer's ordination. Matt Tyne is a friend of mine I went to Thomas Aquinas College with, who was a total like mileage geek, like one of those like mileage hobbyists and plane taking hobbyists, and he got so into flying and all that he became a pilot for United. so I need to get Matt Tyne on the phone, and Matt Tyne, if you're listening, give me a call. I need some advice on how to get silver status between now and the end of the year. Anyways, oh, Google, I'm like, how did I get on that? The Google programmer in first class that I was. Oh, now I've ran out of segment. All right. I'll tell you why the Google programmer is causing me consternation about my iPhone when I get back. You're listening to The Counterposition. I am your host, Andrew Whaley.
I'm a sacred word to mutter. Ran too fast and turned to butter. I'm a bit too much for me to chew.
If you enjoy listening to Andrew Whaley on The Counterposition, you should become a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
I'm a skip across the pond. I'm an ocean on and on. I'm a fish with no bowl that I outgrew. Lift my blood. The only one on track.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your ever so humble servant and host here on this little thing that we like to call The Counterposition. On biggity 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 bread box media. See, I should do more of the biggity 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 thing, you know, kind of like, you know, it's like kind of early 90s rap thing, you know. Well, I started that whole jokingly saying bread box, like bread box, and all that stuff, because we changed the name of Real Life Radio back then. We were the virtual version of this thing, and we became our own company, and everybody kept thinking I was saying red box, like where you go rent a DVD outside of McDonald's or whatever. So yeah, anyway, back to the Google guy. So I was on this flight to Santa Cruz, and I got a cheap upgrade to first class, and so I took it. And I love sitting in first class, which I've told you about yesterday. Besides the free drinks, besides the actually having a human amount of space for a man of substance such as myself, you know, you meet the most interesting people, and I had a long conversation with this guy. So anyway, as I told you yesterday, he told me about the OnePlus. I guess it's called OnePlus. It's a phone. I think it's a Chinese phone, but they're like me. But it's being designed or something out of the Bay Area. And it's a couple $100. It's unlocked. And this Google guy says it's the best Android phone he's ever had. $200. Unlocked. Nothing more. I could drop $200. And so I got this new iPhone. I was like, God, this thing's like $750. I'm like, I'm going to be paying on this thing forever on this Verizon plan. And I know what you're thinking. Why in the world do you have Verizon? Because regardless of what the commercials say, I bump into coverage that works pretty well most of the time when I have Verizon. And when I had Sprint and when I've had AT&T, that didn't happen. And I travel a ton for work. So I've never been to Flint, Michigan. I don't know what they have there, but I have the highest percentage of chance of my Verizon phone actually having a signal. And if I need to download a file or something, it'll work, right? So I bite the bullet and pay too much for my cell phone because I'm out there on the road trying to save the world one cup of coffee at a time. So I was thinking, man, decision paralysis. Gosh, what if I return this? Well, I got 30 days to return it. I'm like, okay, it's 30 something bucks for a restocking fee. How much? And then I remembered, wait a minute. No. You're going to repair the screen for $100, trade it in. They told me to do so. They told me where to go. So I'm like, repair the screen, trade it in. And they have a promotion going right now where that little trade in is going to get me $550, which is going to make the iPhone basically the same price as the Plus One. Decision paralysis over. I'm still Apple for a couple years. But it's amazing how we always think there's something better. And it's fear of missing out, FOMO. It's fear of not being savvy. It's fear of not getting the best deal. It's fear of being sheeple and just doing what everyone else is doing, you know. It's fear of not being the one who was, you know, sharp enough to see through the smoke and get the real thing for cheap, you know. And if it weren't for that $550 promotion, I think I probably, based on what I would have seen, that was enough for me to make the jump to Android and try it for once, because there's no harm, no foul. It's a couple hundred bucks, but I'm not going to do it. So, oh, Apple Kool-Aid, you still taste delicious. All right, so I'm going to Flint, Michigan this weekend. Man, this is what I love to do. This is like, there's two things I love to do in this world. And I did one of them in Santa Cruz, and I did one of, and I'm doing one of them this weekend. And I'll do both of them this weekend. One of them is to preach the vision of Calyx and what I'm doing, to get people to get excited about reaching out to people that are not like them through making hospitality and making people feel at home, right? To create a place for the other as other, because to love, to will the good of the other as other is the definition of love. And I want to help people create places that are Catholic places that embody love for everyone, so that we can earn the right to be heard and be converted ourselves by loving and serving, and hopefully bring some people more deeply into the kingdom of God. And I love preaching that process and that vision and the theology and the spirituality of doing that, the being present, the sanctifying work, the creating something beautiful, the treating strangers as if they're Christ, the sharing of our personal narrative in the small mundane conversations that happen day in and day out, which is no different than saying that God is a God of Israel and the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, the God of Abraham. You know, the God that threw those horses and chariots into the sea, the God who delivered us from the Egyptians, you know, those God, that God. It's saying the God that to share my personal narrative over time in a very organic, normal way, the way people normally share their lives, just in community, in hospitality, and, you know, through hospitality, in community, in relationship, just. And then over time, committing myself to a deep, deep engagement, a real, real encounter with the divine that will just show through in the cracks. And people can go, oh, and maybe ask questions and maybe be drawn and maybe say, maybe become open or want to seek, you know, through that engagement with me in the encounter that I'm having in a day-to-day basis, and within my network of friends and my web of friendships, you know. And so there you go. There's a mini sermon. I love preaching that gospel in detail, loud to whoever will listen. And the other thing I love to do is I love what's possible. And in the realm of what's possible, I love nothing more than looking at a place. So you know what? I'm going off the script here, but good. If I run out of time, or maybe I just won't talk about the debate I never talked about. I'm looking for an excuse not to talk about Donald Trump ever again. You know, when I was a little kid, my mom and dad were business owners. And I remember my dad, I remember him owning a gas station in the middle of Deloge, Missouri. And I was like six, I think. And I used to go there and hang out sometimes, and I really, really loved, you know, kind of watching my dad pump gas and work on cars and stuff like that. But then my dad sold that, and he bought this little liquor store on the corner down the street. And I grew up just behind the counter. My favorite times when I was a kid was sitting behind the counter with my dad, watching him make small talk, hanging out, you know. And the other thing we would do is I would sell candy to my friends, and I would also burn boxes in the backyard. That's back when we still burned the trash, you know, burned cardboard. I know we were just heathen, just hitting each other over the head with rocks, environmental rocks, just beating the environment over the head with a rock by burning trash. But we were, that's how it was back in the dark ages in the '70s. just burning trash in the backyard. Oh man, I tell you what, a story that I tell, I want to do a sidebar of this sidebar. A story I tell when I'm talking about letting kids be dangerous, and maybe it's not a good idea to always let kids be dangerous, especially boys. I remember me and Matt Bradley were burning trash out behind my dad's shop, and my dad gave me this huge box. I mean, a huge box of like 10 foot, eight, well, it was probably 8 foot. Because I was small. Maybe they were even 6 foot, now that I think about it, because I was pretty tiny. But they were twice as big as me. These big spit fluorescent bulbs that he'd been replacing out. And he just came and said, just get rid of these. So we got this big raging box fire going. And we would throw these giant light bulbs into there, and they'd start heating up and just pop, and glass would fly everywhere. Oh my gosh. Okay, also realize this is like 15 feet from the drive-thru where cars are driving. People with their windows down, arm hanging out the window, just bought some beer and the cigarettes. And I am literally like got a giant fire going, and I am throwing light bulbs into the fire and watching them explode with my friend Matt. I tell you what, there's no better fun for a 7-8 year old boy than blowing up light bulbs in a fire behind a liquor store. that should be the motto of the shop. The counter position, the blowing up of light bulbs and a box fire behind a liquor store of radio. Why did I get on that? Oh, so I remember now. My mom and dad were kind of like budding entrepreneurs, and they were interested. And so what they would do is that we would always go for these rides on Sunday. That was back when the blue laws were still firmly in place. So my mom and dad were off on Sunday because we owned a liquor store. And so, you know, we would always go for a ride out in the country. Back when I was real young, it'd be after mass, after dinner at my aunt's house. My great aunt raised my dad, and so we would go to her house for dinner, kind of like you go to grandma's, and Sunday dinner with the family, and then we would go for a long drive out in the country. And inevitably, on the way out of town or way back into town, we would end up looking at empty buildings. And I saw it was the strangest thing that they did, you know, that my mom and dad would look at these in the windows of these empty buildings. And then I would listen to them talk about stuff, and you could tell that they were talking about, you know, what kind of business you could put in there, or why did that fail, or, you know, what they could have done differently. to what could have been done differently to make the business work, you know? And so I just kind of picked up the whole entrepreneurship thing from, you know, in the back seat of my dad's car, listening to them talk about these empty buildings that we're looking at. So I've always had a penchant for looking at empty buildings and thinking about what they could be. Now, what does that have to do with what I'm going to do in Flint, Michigan? Well, that's a story for the other side of the break, because I got distracted and told stories about blowing up light bulbs. You're listening to The Counter Position. I am your host, Andrew Whaley. We'll be right back.
Then how we crave a hanging in the dark.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
People singing, please don't stay, but please don't go.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, well, so after taking a tour through looking at empty buildings with my mom and dad and learning about entrepreneurship, blowing up light bulbs in a box fire behind a liquor store in Deloge, Missouri, I am back full circle to tell you why I'm going to Flint, Michigan. You know what's funny is that listening to The Counterposition, and a bunch of you that are listeners are friends of mine. I don't know what percentage of my listeners are friends of mine, but a bunch of my friends listen, and they will attest to this. Listening to The Counterposition is when it's good, or when it's kind of flowing pretty good, is a lot like hanging out with me. I just get on these rabbit trails and start telling stories. And this is The Counterposition. This is what you get if I'm behind the counter to a great extent. And I am that little diatribe where I would have gone from, hey, what are you doing this week? And I'm going to Flint, Michigan. What are you doing? Man, you know, I'm just like, here, you know what I love doing? I love looking at old buildings. What the hell is that about? Well, okay, when I was a kid, you know, and I'll just, and then I would get distracted, start laughing and tell a story about blowing up light bulbs. I love telling that story about me and Matt Bradley blowing up light bulbs. That along with the snake that bit my boot heel, and a haunted house story and a couple others. Like, I mean, I should just write a book of my top 20 favorite stories. Just tell my stupid stories and let someone write them down. Who knows? Maybe I'll be the next guy who writes stories. I can't think of anybody who writes that kind of story this morning. All right, so why am I going to Flint, Michigan? Because there is a church up there, and they have an old rectory. And we are strongly considering turning said rectory into a coffee house and a gallery. So, and we're gonna. So I am heading up yonder to Flint, Michigan. And I'm going to have, so I'm going to see that, and they've got a basement they're talking about doing a performance space in and some stuff. And I'll end up, you know, the way I'm always harping about Shrine Coffee, shrinecoffee.com, go give them some money. You'll probably start hearing me harp about this project because I'm getting in on the ground floor working on this new project up in Michigan. I love seeing what's possible. I love looking at a context, at a neighborhood. I love figuring out demographics. I love looking at who's around and what they do. You know, I've talked about this 1,000 times, but the three H's: habitat, habits, and hunger. It's like a fishing metaphor, right? You know, when you're trying to fish, you think about where do they go? When do they go there? What do they do when they're there? What do they accept as normal and an extension of kind of a place where they as a fish should be? And when they're there, when they go to the place they go and they're doing anything that they do and being who they are in their place, what looks like food to them? What makes, what ignites hunger in them and causes them to react in a way that they do when they're hungry, right? Hint, that's what we should do. As Catholics, if you want to reach anyone. I'm not sure that Catholics in mass want to reach anyone, but if you do want to reach someone, that's how you do it, right? You put yourself in their shoes and you build something for them. So I love seeing a blank slate or kind of, you know, going and looking at what paint is on the palette. You know, what do we have? What can we, you know, we're going to go into this building and I'm going to say, okay, this is a weight supporting wall. It can be altered, but it can't be moved. Okay, that post has to stay there. Okay, these two rooms can be combined. Okay, cool. We can take this wall out. Right on. All right. Okay, where's the entrance going to be? Okay, bar. We need to put a bar in. Where's it? What will customers see when they come in? Where? What will the noise level be right there? Oh, no, we can't put that discussion area right there because that's going to be right next to the around the corner from the grinder. Okay, here's what we'll do. And I love figuring out who we're trying to provide a place for, what we're trying to provide for them, how to do it in this place with all the confines. You know, in poetry, I love to write free verse. Not that you could be convicted of writing poetry at any point anymore, but I like to write free verse, and because I just don't like to be constrained. But when it comes to things like this, I had a consulting client come to me not too long ago, and he said, I want to buy normally people are either renting or buying a building. We're remodeling something, right? This guy wanted to buy a lot and put a shop in from the ground up. And I was going to have to design the parking lot and the layout of the whole acre or whatever, you know, or half acre. And I did it. I mean, I figured it out. I came up with something that we didn't move forward with, but I have up my sleeve that I would really like to see done at some point. But it took me a while. I had to readjust because I'm used to having to write a sonnet, so to speak, or a haiku, you know, where there's some constraints. You can, inside these constraints, you can play as much as you want, but you can't. And this was a for-profit business that was just there to do something cool that people would pay for. And I had a lot to track what side of the street it was on and where the entrances were legally allowed to go were literally my only constraints. And it took me a while to adjust to that as a consultant because I'm used to dealing with a little more skeletal structure on, you know, and limits on a space and a project, right? So I get to go up there and figure out what to do with this place and just vision what's possible. And at the same time, preach the reason why we would do such a thing and kind of teach these principles on the fly by preaching these principles as we come to possibilities and solutions for different constraints and stuff. Those are the two. So that, and just straight up preaching the vision is what I'm love to do. That the creative coming up with something to do with this blank canvas of a building, and the I have the hiccups now, excuse me, hold on, let me get a sip of coffee here. So coming up with that and then just preaching the vision, but the two things I love to do, and I get to do that this weekend in Flint, Michigan. Now I have to admit, Flint's been in the news here lately about this lead in the water, and they got some of that dialed in, but the pipes have been pretty trashed by the whole process. And I heard they're still having problems with their water, if not as much lead. But so I am thinking on a very technical level that I'm going to have to dive back in to the cutting edge science of water filtration and figure out exactly what we need to do. But I tell you what, I mean, if we could have delicious, free, drinkable water in addition to delicious coffee made with said water, it sounds horrible that in a modern American city that would be a draw, but it might. So I don't know. I don't know if they've got that dialed in or not. But hey, while I'm up there, I'm going to see the lovely and talented Mark Gieschek, my partner on the counter position or on the over the counter podcast, which we haven't done one in forever because he's been on sabbatical and I'm so busy, and he's working on his licentiate thesis, I think, for his, you know, the pontifical degrees. And so, but we're going to do a brand new episode of over the counter podcast, and I'm going to get Mark on the show for an episode of the counter position. And then we're going to go over on Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, we're going to go to Cultivate Coffee and Tap House in Ypsilanti, Michigan, with the other Catholic coffee guy, Billy Kangas. And we're going to bro down and hopefully get, we might get another three-way conversation with Mark and I on for the Over the Counter podcast. But I'm hoping to get a good solid counter position out of that too. So we're going to be, my two projects are going to be fighting for who gets each interview as we run around. And yeah, so I always drag all this equipment to go record and hope to get interviews while I'm out of town, and it never happens. But we're definitely, Mark is my podcast partner and I'm bringing my gear. So it's like, we're definitely going to get it. We'll get an interview with Mark. And we'll definitely get a new episode of Over the Counter podcast. So some of you contrarians that listen to both of those will get a new episode of me and Mark talking for an hour. I love the change up of having a consistent dialogue partner. I should get the occasional repeated guest that I kind of like have a co-host, because I really love that banter back and forth instead of just doing this thing that I do, or just interviewing someone for the first time maybe, or like every once in a while. I love kind of that co-host thing. You know, I was listening to Armstrong and Getty, which are conservative kind of talk show guys, when I was driving over the hill. Okay, I'm just gonna adjust this microphone here, so bear with me, the angle is wrong, that's what's happening. All right, so I was listening to Armstrong and Getty. We have an episode called Shower Thoughts with a guy named Rich from Denver. I need to find this Rich guy from Denver and interview him. and he said the other day that what was it that the growing up is like being slowly transitioned into a management position that you didn't want and you didn't interview for, but they're just putting you in it anyway. Oh, that is so true. There is just stuff that I have to do because I am a grown man in my 40s that if someone gave me that as a job position, hey, I go, no, I suck at that. I'm not going to do that. I want to do what I'm good at, and I'm not good at that. So I'm not going to do it. I think that's what it comes down to. When it's all said and done, I am not good at adulting. I'm a non-adulter. Man, this cheap arm that I put this mic on is just falling apart right now. Oh, stupid. I get the hard tech figured out, all the little settings and everything, and now I'm being sabotaged by a weak spring in the need for a screwdriver. See, adulting. I'm not very good at the whole adulting thing. All right, when we get back, I have three segments left. That was all the stuff that I was going to talk about in my first segment. It's that kind of show today, folks. All right. I'll either punt on some of this or do it a little more briefly. You're listening to The Counter Position. I am your host, Andrew Whaley.
Then all the color glass that painter's palettes mash, all the colors of my soul.
If you enjoy listening to Andrew Whaley on The Counter Position, you should become a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
I'm a hyena laughing fool. I'm a hero without anyone to save. Love decked myself in toys. I'm a poor and kingly boy. Oh, I'm lovely, and I'm dumb.
Welcome back to The Counter Position. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Redbox Media. All right. Final segment. The French press coffee is flowing. And I'm picking up speed here. All right. So, just in passing, okay, I know I have griped about this Matrix thing and Elon Musk and the... You know, so if you haven't been listening, okay, so Elon Musk, the guy that founded, I think he founded PayPal, sold it off, then got the Tesla and his SpaceX and a big solar panel company, Tesla Powerwall. I'm a giant fan of Elon Musk. I think he's an incredible entrepreneur, and he's kind of the Tony Stark for reals, right? He's a really weird dude, though. And one of his weirdnesses is that he is... convinced that there's like 1 in a billion chance that we're in base reality and thinks that we are in fact in an ancestor simulation done by our future post-human selves. As strange as that sounds, there's an argument there why he thinks that. And it has to do with the increasing exponential movement towards reality-like simulation. And that it's inevitable that we will get to a place where we could simulate. So the chances of what are the chances that we haven't done it yet? Maybe we already did and we're living in it. And there's a bunch of arguments. And I've always said, you know, I've been like, well, why would you think this? Now this sounds like an eccentric guy. He thinks too much and he's got this in his head, but no one else would think that. Actually, there's a bunch of people thinking that. So then some people from Bank of America said that they quoted Musk and another guy and said that there is a 20 to 50% chance that we are living in a simulation. So these are advisors for Bank of America. So now it's like, okay, there are people out there that are starting to get this idea, right? Now, two things I ask myself. A, how could someone possibly think this? What evidence would there be for it? And B, is there any way that someone on a wide scale could start believing something so crazy? Well, think about this. 15 years ago, 10 years ago, would you believe that there would be a widespread, across the board, you'd see references to it all over television shows about it, where we would say that there's no connection, per se, between biological sex and gender. That somehow gender is not a social, it is a social construct, but you can be born the wrong gender. And we don't question how those are both possible. And we are openly talking about people have boy bodies but girl minds. And no one can point to where that happens in the brain. It's not a physical reality, but it's not social construct per se. And then science would come up and go, no, it's not. We've looked at that. It doesn't play out. There's no scientific evidence whatsoever. And it has become massively believed. So I take this very seriously. I have, this has been in science fiction. It's been in philosophy all the way back to Descartes. It's been in philosophy in more recent times, like simulacra and simulation. And it's been in popular culture, like in The Matrix and different science fiction things. And now there are people talking about it as if it's a real strong possibility. Well, now a new article came out I was reading, and it turns out this guy that's a part of Y Combinator, I think it is, which is a big funding thing in Silicon Valley, big investment, what do you call it? Investment thing. And said that there's $2 billion tech moguls, billionaires, that are paying scientists to work on a solution to break us out of the matrix. So here's what's interesting, though, is there is partially some reasons that they consider evidence for us being in the matrix. And they come down into two different species of evidence. And I would argue that both of them in a saner time would be evidence of the divine. And so the first one is not very scientific, but it's maybe more human. And that would be just a discontent with the way things are, right? Just something just seeming just like not just off about reality, right? I remember when I was a little kid, I've talked about this several times, but I'll tell it again. When I was a little kid, I was absolutely convinced that things were not the way they're supposed to be. I just knew it. I felt it in the core of my bones. This isn't how it was supposed to be. Now, you know what? My old man was an alcoholic and, I had been abused when I was pretty young. And so, I was already had some problems going on. So you could just chalk it up to kind of a trauma damaged kid, later on parents of divorce and stuff. Parents were divorced and stuff. You just chalk it up to a troubled kid combination of troubled kid being kind of dreamy and liking to think out loud and come up with ideas and just over observe everything. Great. Maybe so. But all I know is whenever I heard the story of the fall, even in its kind of its cartoonish kind of like big picture, kind of like, mythical form, I was like, oh, I know what they're talking about. Now, there's a great example of that, like in The Matrix, where he says, he's talking about, it wasn't deja vu, it's about like something not seeming right or whatever. And he said, and Morpheus says, I know just what you mean. And he meant, I know what's happening underneath reality and why you feel that way. And it is because you're living in a simulation. And so I think that the base human experience of reality somehow falling short of the way things ought to be, this brokenness in the center of being, is makes you at least willing to look at these ideas, right? Now, the second thing that we see that the UCM using falls under the rubric of kind of like order. So it's the universe is ordered. It's described. You could describe it mathematically. You can have predictable laws and all this stuff. We've always looked at that and said, oh, wow, reality is ergonomic to mind. We can know, we can look around and understand things. We can understand principles and laws, and we can make predictions about how things will act and all that based on those laws. And we've always said, well, that's because reality at one point was inside of consciousness. It's ergonomic to consciousness. It was inside mind. God has spoke, and there was a concept before he spoke. We're created in his image, and that we're intellectual beings, that and we have will. So, of course. And so that's why science arose deeply in the West. That's why people who are religious, who think that in the Christian world, we go out looking for reality and expecting to be able to understand it, because it used to be in mind. so you have a certain boldness, right, to go look at reality. Well, these guys have abandoned the idea of a divine person, a divine observer, a divine creator, a divine thinker and speaker, or the logos, the understanding, the underlying understanding, the underlying reasonableness, the understanding meaning underneath all of being. And so when they see something that looks ordered or looks teleological, something that looks made, something that looks like it is designed, they go, so we're in this really dangerous place where now there's a theory out there and I could say, me and Father Robert Spitzer could sit down with Elon Musk, have a cup of coffee, and he would say, but look, we have an anthropic universe. The distance from the sun, all this stuff, the gravitational constant, all this stuff, it all adds up to the existence of life and the complexity that we have. We have a universe that seems to be bent towards us being able to exist. And Elon Musk would say, exactly, that's because we made this universe. You know, you look at like quantum mechanics, there's been this problem that I don't have time to go into, but you know, the measurement and the effects of measurements in the quantum world and the need for an observer. And some people have posited that this need for an observer that's been discovered in quantum mechanics is evidence of an observer that predates any of us and that is bigger than all being and all creation, because it has to be there for the first thing to happen, and therefore God, right? And they go, no, and now they're going, no, and that's why we need an observer, is because they are observing. So we've gotten to this place where it's like, if this theory catches hold, and that sounds crazy, but so did a complete disconnect between biological sex and gender, right? There's a million crazy things we believe now. If this theory catches hold, and the people who talk about memes and stuff to get us going are working on this and throwing billions of dollars at it, then now all the evidences that we have for God will now be used as evidences that we're in fact in a video game. Oh man. Well, maybe Jesus will come back and they'll think that the guy that programmed it just showed up to check on it. Well, I got two things I didn't get to, but as luck would have it, we do this most days. And so, we'll do it next time. So, all right, let's pull the plug, pop the cork on another episode of The Counterposition. Thanks for coming out.
I take your place, marble stone. I take your place, marble stone.